Johnson is the best-selling author of the incredibly popular Walt Longmire mystery series. The books, 13 in all, have won multiple awards, including the Western Writers of America Spur Award for Fiction. And of course, the books are the inspiration for the popular A&E TV series, Longmire. Craig lives in U-Cross, Wyoming, population 25. Today we'll speak with him about the newest title in his series, Dry Bones. Welcome, Craig. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report.
Well, please. Pleasure's all mine.
Well, 13 books ago, what made you pick up the pen and start writing?
You know what? It was one of those things where, you know, there are always two reasons why somebody becomes a writer. And the first one is you stumble across a story that you think needs to be told. And then the other one is you run out of excuses, because I'm firmly of the belief that everybody's got a writer inside them. The problem is they generally have an editor inside them who strangles them to death before they get anything written on paper. And so that was pretty much what I wanted to do. Like, the other thing was is that, you know, it was a time period when everything was all about CSI. Everything was all forensics, ballistics, all that type of stuff. And I talked to a DCI investigator in Wyoming and asked him, I said, how long does it take you guys to get DNA evidence? And he paused for a second. And he says, is this a high-profile case? And I said, yeah. And he goes, let's say it is. And he said, about 9 months.
Oh.
And so it seemed to me that what they were doing, you know, with all the television shows and all the books and everything, it just really wasn't honest. And so I thought, well, what if you had the protagonist of your books be the, you know, sheriff of the least populated county in the least populated state in America? And that's how Walt Longmire began.
I see. Well, in Dry Bones' opening acknowledgments, you share how you became interested in dinosaur excavations in the American West. Can you tell our listeners that story?
Well, I'm not that much of an aficionado of dinosaurs, but I was actually happened to be overseas. I do a number of foreign tours. And every once in a while, my daughter and granddaughter kind of glom onto those trips. Like, and so I have a 6-year-old attached to me most of the time. Like, and she's absolutely lovely. Like that. But we happen to be at the Museum of Natural History in London, and we went in. Like that. And they had a giant T-Rex there. Like that. And you know, it was very impressive. Like, and I looked down and saw the plaque said that it was from Niobrara County, Wyoming. And so it made me kind of aware, and I started looking every time I went into a museum to see where the T-Rexes were from, and they always seemed to come from Wyoming. And so I contacted a paleontologist buddy of mine, and I said, what's the story on this? And he goes, oh, yeah, it's kind of a hotbed area, that northern Rockies, you know, Powder River region, like that, an awful lot of the, you know, the T-Rexes that you'll see in all the major museums around the world, you know, are from our area. And so I got thinking about it, and I remembered the story of Sue. I don't know if you recall, like it was the largest, most intact T-Rex ever found right across the border over in South Dakota. And it kind of turned into a big media sensation simply because the rancher whose property the T-Rex was found on attempted to sue the people who found it. Like that. And the problem was he was an Indian rancher, and then the tribe stepped in and said, you know what, it's actually all of ours. Like that. And that's when the federal government stepped in and said, you know what, it was actually on leased land, so it belongs to all of us. And so all I could think was, boy, does that sound like a Walt Longmire mystery novel.
I'll say. You know, I learned so much about dinosaurs reading your book. Like you said, the dinosaurs have walked the face of the earth for 165 million years, while human beings have only been around for 200,000 years. How much time did you spend researching before you started writing this book?
You know, that's one of the great things about being a writer is you can just lay there on the sofa and be, you know, reading, you know, and I tell my wife, don't bother me, I'm working here, you know, and, but it's fun because, I mean, that's one of the great things about the job is you get to go out and do the research on all the things you want to learn about, you know, and I was so curious about it, and, you know, I mean, I had a, you know, passing knowledge, but certainly not enough to write the book. So it was a learning experience for me, too, and then the other thing that was kind of shocking to me was to find out how many of these, you know, big scientists, you know, Marsh and Cope and the dinosaur wars that happened in Wyoming, like that, for the Peabody Museum at Yale, like that, and the Carnegie and all these others. Like, it was kind of interesting to find out that these guys, you know, hated each other and, you know, tried to sabotage each other's digs. And, you know, the anger between the two got to the simple point where one actually had, after the other one had died, had his skull on his desk. And you just don't think about that kind of, you know, petty activity between scientists. You would think that they were above that type of thing, but evidently not.
Well, introduce us to Dinosaur Jen, who is kind of the focal point of your book.
She is like that. She's kind of the counterpoint to Sue, like that. She's discovered, you know, in Walz County, there in Absaroka, like that, and it becomes you know, an awful lot like the circus that happened, you know, with Sue, and you know, of course it involves, you know, the family that's that happens to own the ranch, you know, where it takes place, and you know, of course my situation, my story and my take on this is a little bit different from the actuality, but it borrows an awful lot from the actual story that happened over there in the Hill City in South Dakota. But in my book, of course, it starts out with a little bit more drama in the sense that Walt and Vic get called out, you know, to this rancher's property, and there's a large reservoir there like that, and there's a fisherman standing there on the side of the reservoir, and he's got a handful of rocks that he's tossing into the water, and Vic's response is that some kind of weird Wyoming fishing technique that I don't know about? Walt says, well, I don't know, let's go find out. And he walks over and says, hey, Omar, what are you up to? Look at, and he says, I'm trying to keep the snapping turtles off that body that's floating out there in the water. And, you know, it's a little bit more of a dramatic take on the whole thing to get the ball rolling. But that's actually a story that I got from a Wyoming sheriff, like that his grandfather was a sheriff, and they were going out fishing one morning, and he got a call like that, and they went and answered it, and he got his first introduction, I guess, to what sheriffing is all about.
Ah, so Absaroka County has a population of 2,483 citizens in 9,000 square miles. And your hometown, New Cross, Wyoming, has a population of 25. I'm guessing your hometown is the inspiration for Absaroka?
Well, about 30 miles down the road, there's a little town called Buffalo, Wyoming. And that's kind of the basis for Durand. And Absaroka County doesn't really exist. Like that, there are only 23 counties in Wyoming, like that. But I took a clue, you know, from Faulkner, and thought, you know what, maybe if I use, you know, a fictitious county, maybe this would be a good idea, because it'll give me a little bit more creative freedom, like that, to write what it is that I want to write, and I'd have to answer, you know, all the documentary questions that a lot of people might have if I based it on an actual town and an actual county. So that's how the 24th county in Wyoming began.
We're speaking with Craig Johnson on the Book Report. Can you tell us about the evolution of Walt's relationship with Undersheriff Vic Moretti?
You know what, when I first started out the books, you know, you get a lot of advice from a lot of other authors, and one of the first things they said was you can have sexual tension between the characters, but you can't have anything happen. And, you know, at least for like, you know, 17 or 18 books or something. And I thought, okay, nothing's going to happen between these characters for 17 or 18 years. What kind of women are you dating anyway? It just didn't seem particularly honest or realistic. And so about the third book, you know, Kindness Goes Unpunished, I went ahead and had, you know, something happen, you know, between the two of them. Because it seemed to me that, you know, the lifeblood of a series of books is how you allow those characters to evolve and to change. You know, we've all started series of books, you know, that start out gangbusters, but then you get about seven or eight books in, and it seems like they're, you know, just, you know, repeating plot lines, and the characters don't seem to be developing or changing or having things happen to them in their lives that cause them to evolve. And so I thought, you know what the heck? All it's going to do is complicate their lives. I'm going to go ahead and have something happen. And it turns out to have been the case.
Talk about Henry Standing Bear. I bet most of your fans think he's one of the best characters of the West.
Henry is the Northern Cheyenne bar owner of the Red Pony Bar and Grill, you know, named for Steinbeck's novel, The Red Pony. Like that, everything always has a literary bent, you know, in my books, like including Walt's office, which is an abandoned Carnegie Library, and Henry's no different. Like he's a remarkable individual, and I based him off of a good friend of mine up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, a fellow by the name of Marcus Red Thunder. And you know, for me, you know, that was another piece of advice that I got, you know, was that, you know, you write what you know and everything. But you know, I took that one a little to heart, simply because, you know, the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow Reservation are just to the north of where my ranch is. They're on the border of Wyoming and Montana, and they're remarkable people. They're incredible people. And, you know, to leave Indians out of a contemporary Western novel just, you know, didn't ring true to me.
In this book, Walt seems to be having some spiritual experiences that he's quite unprepared for. What made you pursue this storyline?
You know, Walt is not the most spiritual individual. He's a kind of an empirical data kind of guy. He likes to see things that are tangible, feel things that are tangible, and make, you know, adjustments and lines of thought, you know, that are tangible. And so he's not very given, you know, to the spiritual world, you know. But, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, there's that great quote from Shakespeare, there are greater things, Horatio, than are dreamt of in thy philosophies. And a lot of time Henry is, you know, the one that's kind of the conduit to allow him to understand some of the spirituality and the things that are happening to him.
I'm gleaning from this interview that you are actually a literature classicist. Is that in your background, too?
I guess to an extent it is. Like, I mean, my education was in writing. Like, I've always been a lifelong reader. You know, I grew up in one of those houses that had, you know, stacks of books everywhere. And I remember, you know, when I started the series, you know, with Walt, I wrote the first two chapters of The Cold Dish, and I just really wasn't satisfied, you know, with the character. He seemed a little stereotypical. He seemed a little cliched. And I thought, well, you know, how can I, you know, give him some, you know, some abilities that would be a little bit, you know, above the, you know, the norm. And I didn't want to make him, you know, the usual protagonist in crime fiction, which is the 6'2" of twisted steel and sex appeal. Every woman wanted him. Every man feared him. He could kill anyone with a number two Ticonderoga pencil in 3.2 seconds, which is my least favorite character in literature and cinema. And so I thought, well, okay, if he is over, he's a little overweight, a little over, you know, age, a little overly depressed, you know, what are the things that I can give him that will give him a real advantage? And so I thought, you know what, have him read. Have him read. You know, I think one of the sadnesses of Walt's life is he probably would have been happier being, you know, a liberal arts, you know, English, you know, teacher somewhere in some little college somewhere, but Vietnam took a hand and he became a military policeman. He got home, he got married, he had a kid, and, you know, the only job open in Absaroka County was a deputy, like, and so he took that job, and that was the path that he went on.
I'm assuming that you're already working on the next one.
I'm actually on chapter 15. I think I've got only like two chapters and an epilogue before I'll be finished with next year's book. I like Walt's company. I enjoy his company, so I tend to, you know, write hard.
Well, so do your millions of readers. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you. My pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure.
Thanks, Craig.
You bet.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.